Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of New Books in Archaeology. I'm your host, Samuel Pfister, and joining me today is Dr. Allison Mickle, here to talk about her recent book, Why Those Who Shovel Are Silent, out now from University Press of Colorado. Allison is Assistant Professor of Anthropology in the Department of Sociology and Anthropology at Lehigh University, and a core faculty member in Global Studies and the Center for Global Islamic Studies. Her research focuses on how local communities have impacted and been affected by the long history of archaeological work in the Middle East. Currently a fellow at the American Center of Research in Jordan, Allison is joining us today from Amman. Allison, welcome.
Thank you so much. I am so happy to be here.
Yeah, really great to have you on the show. So tell us a little bit about Why Those Who Shovel Are Silent, a little bit about the book.
Absolutely. Yeah. So this is the culmination of 6 years of ethnographic and oral history research. It focuses on the history of archaeology in both Jordan and Turkey, but really aims to talk about the history of archaeology in the Middle East more broadly. And its focus in particular is on labor in archaeology. My own experience in archaeology was that we would work very closely with locally hired laborers. But they weren't always credited or mentioned in final publications. And that seemed to be the norm in archaeology. And so I wanted to do a research project that really focused on them and their contributions to archaeology. And so the book focuses on Çatalhöyük in Turkey and Petra in Jordan, and specifically the Temple of the Winged Lion site within Petra, Jordan. And I did interviews with site workers at both those sites, current and former, and tried to understand what expertise they had about archaeology. And in the book, I lay out the expertise that I've found that they developed from years of working in archaeology. In Petra, especially, there are people who have worked for 40 or 50 years on different archaeological projects. In Çatalhöyük, there are also people with decades of experience as well, not necessarily quite that longevity, but also these long careers in archaeology. And so people definitely have developed expertise in archaeology at both of these sites. But what I kept finding was that people would deny that they had expertise anytime I tried to name it. So we would have these long conversations where they would tell me about dating Nabataean pottery, or how far you have to dig before you find a destruction layer, or identifying lithics, obsidian sources, Çatalhöyük. And then when I would try and name what they had shared with me as expertise, they would say, oh, no, I don't have expertise. I'm just a simple worker. And I found this at both sites. And so the book really digs into why that is. And what I argue is that archaeologists at both sites have inadvertently created economies for workers where it is actually more lucrative for them, more financially rewarding for workers to pretend like they are ignorant about archaeological sites, to protest that they're simple, to claim a lack of knowledge about those sites. And so I go through in the book the different ways in which that has arisen, the ways in which that has occurred, the long history of labor dynamics in archaeology in the Middle East and around the world. I don't think that it's a hopeless situation, though. And so in the book, I also hope to kind of shine a light on a path forward and suggest some ways that we could actually leave that legacy behind and produce better science by encouraging workers to share expertise that they demonstrably have rather than encouraging them to hide it.
So like you mentioned, your research draws on your participation in two archaeological research projects in the Middle East, the Temple of the Winged Lion Cultural Resource Management at Petra and the Çatalhöyük research project in Turkey. So can you tell us a little bit more about those projects and your participation in those projects?
Yeah, absolutely. I want to be careful not to frame the project as comparative because I really did not intend it that way. I'm not trying to say, that these are necessarily comparable or that we can learn something by laying them against one another. These projects actually have really similar histories. And so I thought instead of a comparative story, it could kind of be a complementary story because both sites, Petra and Çatalhöyük, are World Heritage Sites. Both sites, the Temple of the Winged Lions and Çatalhöyük specifically, began excavations in the 60s or 70s. And both sites today are places where archaeologists are trying to lead community engagement initiatives. So both at the Temple of the Winged Lions and at Çatalhöyük, the contemporary projects place a lot of emphasis on social outreach and community engagement and trying to bring people from the local community into the project. And so I thought by looking at both of these projects, we could learn something about that long history of archaeological work because there were like 50, 60 years of work in the end at these two sites. What was helpful about looking at these two sites also is that the Temple of the Winged Lions had a very long-term project that started in the 70s, and the Çatalhöyük Research Project had a long-term project that began in the 90s. And so those two sites had these large archives built up about what had been found at the two sites during these long periods. They both had these shorter engagements at the Temple of the Winged Lions more recently and at Çatalhöyük more early on with James Mellart. But I really wanted to focus on those long-term projects and what they were doing. So at the Temple of the Winged Lions, I did a lot of oral historical research. I did a lot of archival research. I went through all the site notebooks from the project. And then on the contemporary project, I served as a sort of an ethnographic consultant. Interviews with the local community about the current project and what was going on with it, and then helped to sort of shape some of those community outreach initiatives that were going on there. And then at Çatalhöyük, I served as an excavator on the team. And so I dug in the Çatalhöyük buildings. I led, students working there. And I also worked with the workers that we had hired at Çatalhöyük. So I was both a participant and a ethnographic researcher, outside researcher on these two projects. So I was able to kind of both have an insider view of what was going on in these sites and really have that in-depth understanding of what was coming out of these sites, the material, artifacts, how the work was going. And not to downplay like the setting, the environment, the weather, like those are things that you need to have of a site to really understand what it's like to work there. I both was working on the two sites, but also delving into the archival material from them and doing these oral historical interviews with previous site workers there.
Great. And during your research and during your participation in these projects, you were obviously interacting with the communities of local site workers and the communities of the people who lived around these sites. But was there ever a moment when, was there a moment when this research project idea really came about? Did you ever have that sort of aha moment when you decided that this was an inquiry really worth pursuing?
Yeah, I mean, I think there were sort of two separate aha moments. I think the first one, maybe it was not an aha moment. It was an aha formation, an aha transformation. But I first excavated when I was 18. I went to Kenya. I did field work there. And I was a very nervous excavator. I like to think I have, some skills now, but I didn't when I started. My walls were not straight. My floors were not flat. I'm sure I was the queen of picking artifacts out of the bulk. Just not great, not great skills. I can admit it. We can all admit to the mistakes when we were 18,
We were all there. Yeah.
We were all there. You know, I think this is the healthy therapeutic release that archaeology needs, is just to accept that those mistakes happen with when you bring children to the field. And I was a child. Yeah. I own it.
A rite of passage is definitely picking through a plaster floor or something and not realizing until you're on the other side.
Exactly. Absolutely. We all need to air this out. So that was me when I was 18. Also, we were excavating on a slope and I just couldn't visualize in my head how you could excavate stratigraphically on a slope. That just didn't really make sense. I didn't know if you should excavate like with the slope or not. It just was very confusing to me. So we had a locally hired worker on the project named Moses. My kind of trench supervisor kept telling me to watch Moses and copy him and do what he did. And that was, I don't know, maybe it was an aha moment now that I'm thinking back on it, because I really came to that project thinking like, oh, I'm a major, you know, in anthropology. I've taken 3 whole classes in archaeology. Like, surely I know what I'm doing. But there's no replacement for hands-on experience, which Moses had and I didn't, and he had a lot of and I had none of. And so, like I said, I'm pretty proud of my excavation skills now, and I really think it's largely due to Moses. I switched to working in the Middle East when I was undergrad. I was studying Arabic. I was really interested in this region and its history. And I started reading about, reading these early memoirs of 18th century explorers and then 19th century and 20th century excavations. And I would read about entire communities that were like full of Moseses. We're full of excavation experts with really clear technical skills and archaeological knowledge. I kind of couldn't believe how many archaeologists, like early archaeologists and early explorers would say, I never would have found this site if I hadn't talked to this guy, you know, or like, this guy really told us how to dig this site. Like, wow, we didn't break anything just because he was there. But without that sort of meta critique or like reflexive understanding that like, they fundamentally relied on these local communities' expertise and generosity, I should say, like willingness to divulge that information. And so I wanted to go and see if these communities today were, or if there were communities like these in other places with long histories of excavation. So in the archaeological archives, you read about Petrie's workers in Egypt, who are famous for being very technically skilled. You read about the Shirkatis in Iraq, who are known for being very skilled. And so I sort of wondered if at other sites with long histories of excavation, if there were other communities like that. So that's how the idea of the project came about. But it was frustrating when I was like so certain that these communities in Petra and in Çatalhöyük surely had this expertise that I could see, that I could talk to them about. Working on the site with Çatalhöyük, I could see the local workers, I could see the skills they had. And then when I would talk to them, they would just like flat out deny it. So when I say there are 2 aha moments, I think there was the aha moment number one of like, wow, local communities who work on archaeological sites for a long time have expertise. How, like, what a concept. This should maybe be documented somehow. And then the second aha moment of realizing, you know, there's got to be something going on here for all of these people who so clearly have this knowledge and skill set to deny that they do. So that's a long answer to your question. But yeah, 2 aha moments, I think.
Great. And so during your actual ethnographic interviews with these local site workers, you noticed that contrary to the traditionally held notions of site workers as uninformed or as really non-participants or as just the manual laborers, site workers at both Petra and Çatalhöyük are and have been historically incredibly knowledgeable about the material and the interpretation of the site. And so why has their part in the archaeological process been so erased? Why haven't more people talked about it?
Yeah, great question. I do think that the contemporary community engagement initiatives at Çatalhöyük and Petra have been attempting to redress that imbalance. I think it's maybe important to remember that Çatalhöyük did put out 1 thematic volume, or maybe 2, where site workers were interviewed along the way and that their direct quotes were included in the publication. Also at Çatalhöyük, the long-term site guard, Sadratin Dural, published his memoirs of being a site guard at Çatalhöyük. And so I don't want to like say wholly that no one has ever, you know, considered this or that they've completely been erased, because certainly that's not the case.
No, sure, of course, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I just don't want to, you know, credit where credit is due, for sure. Mm-hmm. But I do think in general, like structurally in our discipline, it is the norm that you might include the list of local laborers and the acknowledgments. Maybe you take a team photo, put that on the website with names. But the sort of substantive contributions of the workers is not the focus of any sort of site report. That's just not the case. There's also this long-term separation of the physical labor of archaeology and the intellectual labor of archaeology, which is a mythical separation. It's not real. And I think the sort of very now old phrase interpretation of the at the trowel's edge is trying to kind of to disrupt that myth, to challenge it, to make it clear that there is no actual separation between physical and intellectual work. But I think this is a long held belief in archaeology, and certainly people have written about how we've designed recording strategies to be able to kind of make the physical work of actual excavation seem rote and seem unskilled, whereas what happens down the line in the labs and in the publications is more traditionally seen as highly skilled. And so I think that sort of that division between the material and the intellectual, you know, the physical and the scholarly or academic, is underlying a lot of this erasure at both sites, which isn't any one person's fault, or it's a long legacy that we're still contending with, and still a lot of people are working to challenge and maybe even demolish today.
So in what ways do the site workers' recollections and experiences working for these digs from their oral histories about the discoveries and interpretations, how do they actually differ from that of the archaeological staff at these two sites?
Yeah, absolutely. So the difference between the site workers' recollections and what the excavators record is definitely more stark at the Temple of the Winged Lions, at the older project, the one that began in the 70s, which makes sense. This was a site where pretty extreme hierarchies were recognized and, you know, were part of the structure of the project. The site workers reported being sent away anytime anything important was found. And this was a project in the 70s that did not have the ethos of community engagement, because it predates that becoming like a big push in the discipline. And so those differences are really stark. So at Petra, site workers have these really specific recollections of the find locations of particular artifacts. They have memories of not only like where they were found, but the kind of stratigraphic context in which they were found. They have theories and hypotheses about what they were used for. And partly just due to the time period and the specific methodologies used at that site, the archival documents from the Temple of the Winged Lions are very, very structured, and excavators weren't really encouraged to include their interpretations or to go beyond this sort of rote categories that they should record for every context. And so the site workers offer a lot of richness, I would say, that isn't included in the documentation, because the documentation wasn't meant to accommodate fluidity and flexibility. Site workers at Petra, at the Temple of the Winged Lions, also have a lot of recollections of the methods used. So the spits that they dug in when they dug in spits, the tools that they used for particular types of deposits, when they sifted and when they didn't. And a lot of the times that's not recorded in the archival materials either, simply because that wasn't solicited. It wasn't requested. It wasn't information that was requested in the documents. At Çatalhöyük, the site workers have very similar knowledge to the excavators, which I think is a success of the community engagement efforts. You know, there's been a lot of work at Çatalhöyük to reach out to the community and hold days where we explain what we're doing and why we're doing it. as I said, there's a lot of emphasis on bringing the local community in, and on there's also a lot of ethnoarchaeological work at Çatalhöyük that has asked site workers to participate in experimental archaeology projects or to contribute to our understanding of mud brick architecture. And so the key distinction at Çatalhöyük is that site workers see themselves as experts on Neolithic lifeways, because for so many years there have been research projects at Çatalhöyük focused on eliciting information about possible traditional lifeways or foodways or the environment from the local community members. And so those are sort of kind of the key differences. But I also think it's worth recognizing that similarity is also evidence of expertise. And so I kind of, in the book, I show how both could be, we should recognize both of those things as expertise. That's it.
Yeah, so in addition to a lot of the systemic barriers that are in place that keep site workers from being considered knowledge production partners in the archaeological process, in your interviews, you also noticed the phenomenon that frequently a lot of the people you were talking to refused to consider themselves as archaeological experts or as having significant archaeological experience or expertise, despite, like you said, years or even in some cases decades working at sites and being part of archaeological excavations. So to use the title of the book in a question, why are those who shovel silent about their experience? Why are site workers not more demonstrative of their unique expertise?
Yeah, thank you for this question, because this really is the key to the book. This is really like that second aha moment I had was trying to answer this question exactly, because I truly thought I would go in to both of these sites, introduce myself as an archaeologist working with like a current visible, presumably respected archaeological project, and everyone would say, I'm an expert, let me tell you how I'm an expert, because that seemed like what I would do if, you know, I thought there was a possibility of getting a job or getting recognition or something. I'm also a type A Gemini, and so of course that's very natural to me to imagine that you would of course claim your knowledge and expertise. Nobody was. Over and over again, they were saying, oh, I'm so simple. I'm just a Bedouin. I'm just a goat herder, you know? And so that question why was really the driving question of the book. And the answer I found, I couldn't really ask these people directly because there was just so much invested in denying their expertise. But what I kind of put together is that along with telling me that they weren't experts, they were also telling me all of these stories about archaeological projects they had worked on where they would get fired or demoted or somehow punished in another way for demonstrating their expertise. Like they would get replaced by their brother. They would get told, like, don't come to work tomorrow. We'll see you about the next day. They would have their pay docked. And all of these things were happening when people would try and assert their expertise. So if they said, you're digging in the wrong place, or that bowl is Iron Age, not Bronze Age, or whatever. They would have these experiences of being sent away. And some people put it really, you know, really directly for me. One person mentioned that he had gotten a certificate of his like mastery of archaeological expertise. And I really thought like, oh, great, my dissertation is written. Like, I'll just show a picture of this certificate and like, people have expertise, like done. But as soon as he brought it out, he like had to go find it in a back room, and he brought it out, and I was like, wow, so you must show this to all the archaeologists who come through. And he was like, no, I would never show it to anyone. I wouldn't want to seem arrogant. And then another person I talked to talked about the fact that he doesn't work on archaeological projects anymore at all. And he said it was because he had had these experiences so many times of being sent away or chastised or yes, even like fired for correcting the archaeologist. And I kind of said like, wow, like, you know, that's really extreme. And when he was telling me the story, I asked him, you know, do you tell people when you have a better idea? And he was like, well, I learned not to. I don't do that anymore because I tried to do it a bunch of times. And people would say, you're just a worker. We just brought you here to work. We didn't bring you here to ask questions, you know, sit down and be okay with that. So I sort of put together these stories one after another of all of these different times that people had been sent away for challenging archaeological expertise on the part of the director. And it just, it kind of clicked into view that, that of course there's this economy of inexpertise that's been created. And that was particularly true at Petra. It took a little bit of a different form at Çatalhöyük because Çatalhöyük is a community engaged site. They aren't really in the business of firing people for contributing to discussions. In fact, there's been a lot of work to encourage people to contribute to discussions. But a lot of that encouragement has been in the form of soliciting expertise, like I was saying before, that is very focused on Neolithic lifeways and traditional practices like herding goats and baking bread in these big ovens, mud brick architecture. And I'm not saying this to critique those initiatives, but I think people in Çatalhöyük had gotten the impression that that's the valuable knowledge that they held, was to associate themselves with the Neolithic community at Çatalhöyük, and to, you know, sometimes they would overtly say, "I'm a Neolithic woman, I'm a Neolithic person," even though they don't claim any sort of genetic or like biological ancestry from the community of Çatalhöyük. I really think that there had been all of these financial opportunities from the archaeological project itself to pretend like they were Neolithic and therefore sort of simple and therefore like kind of anti-modern or anti-scientific. And so overall, my argument is that even on community engaged projects like Çatalhöyük, which I really enjoyed being on, and I think and all of the individual initiatives that have happened have been really great. Fundamentally, the project doesn't change its labor management practices from what has been the norm in archaeology in this region for so long. And so when you're just doing individual outreach projects like 1111 individually here and there, and you haven't really changed the system in which you hire and pay people and the kind of job that you're hiring them for, then you're not challenging that dichotomy between physical and intellectual labor, even if you want to. So until we really change the economic underpinnings of archaeological excavations, I think we're going to keep seeing the same thing, that people are going to emphasize the lack of knowledge they have about science and about archaeology and about the past.
Yeah, this phenomenon you observe, which you have called lucrative non-knowledge, which I think is a great way to encapsulate this really unique phenomenon in archaeology, is so different from, you know, that of the staff members who are working on archaeological excavations or those on the academic side of archaeology, where every little bit of experience gets its spot on the CV. You know, it's just a vastly different
exactly
way of positioning yourself. Yeah,
exactly. And I couldn't help but think about how my expectation of how workers would behave and respond to my questions was maybe forged through academic conferences where people are making questions that are more of comments and, you know, jockeying to seem like the smartest person in the room. And like that, because that's the culture of academia, is to like out expertise people around you. But the archaeological site isn't really that same space. That's not, you know, the business of academia is a different business from the business of archaeological excavation, right, and fieldwork. So I think that's the one of the crucial findings.
Yeah,
if I can say so in the book.
An important part of ethnography is fleshing out your personal expectations of what you're going to find.
And, exactly. Yeah.
So I want to talk about your methods a little bit. So you had noted that this book is the culmination of combined years of ethnographic work and archaeological work as well in Turkey and Jordan, interviewing and living with the communities around Çatalhöyük and Petra. So how did you develop your research plan, and how did it change over the course of your research? Did your approach to conducting these interviews change as you learned more?
Yeah, absolutely. So I lived in the dig houses associated with the contemporary projects of both sites. So in Petra, that's in the town of Wadi Musa, and at Çatalhöyük, it's actually on the archaeological site. And at both sites, I had a research assistant. I do speak both Turkish and Arabic, but I was working in these small rural communities, and it was just really helpful to have somebody who knew where to find people and could introduce me to them. So I wasn't just, you know, I wasn't doing a door-to-door survey. So it was just really great to have somebody who could, you know, knock on a door and say, like, is Suleiman home? And then, you know, it just really, really helps with that. And then in Turkey, my Turkish is not a rural Turkish. And so I did also have a translator in Turkey who helped me with conducting those interviews. And in terms of how it changed over the time, it's a really great question, because over time, I stopped introducing myself as an archaeologist, which at the beginning I thought would be this great like way in. People would be like, oh, you're an archaeologist? Like, let me tell you about archaeology, which kind of did happen to some extent. But there was always that dynamic of, I think, them were like being distrustful of me saying, I'm an archaeologist, now tell me all of your expertise, because it was so different from past experiences they had had. So I stopped introducing myself as an archaeologist. I stopped asking about expertise as time went on. I sort of dropped that as like a terminology because people were so resistant to it. Once I got a sense of why people were resistant to it, I didn't need it. More examples of people being offended by the question. And then I also, I use network analysis quite a bit in the book, which relied on kind of generating these lists of archaeological finds and methodologies. And so I don't think it's very normal in ethnography to, I don't know, I mean, maybe it is, but I think ethnographic interviews or ethnographic conversations tend to be more open-ended and tend to be more kind of rich and dynamic. But I always ask people the same question of like, what did you find and what methods did you use, so that I could generate those kind of standardized lists that are necessary for network analysis. So that's also something I think that's a little bit unique to the methods that I use versus somebody who's maybe doing a fuller ethnographic study that isn't quite as like targeted in its goal.
Sure. Yeah. I actually wanted to ask you about your use of network analysis. Like you mentioned, I mean, I have never seen someone use network analysis before in an ethnography. So could you give us a little bit of background on, you know, just what is network analysis and how did you use it as a useful tool for analyzing the differences between the knowledge of archaeological staff and the knowledge of site workers and how the differences between how they understand these sites?
Yeah, absolutely. So network analysis is a suite of techniques. It's not just one thing. But in general, these techniques began in the 1930s and 1940s, when a lot of mathematicians and social scientists were wondering how they could study connections between people or connections between things. And so there were a number of attempts to visualize that and to measure that and to study that. It really took off much later in the 20th century. So in the 1970s, Stanley Milgram, who is famous for other studies, but he's also famous for his 6 degrees of separation study, which some people may know about, but it's the study that came up with the idea that you're connected to everyone in the world by no more than 6 degrees. You know somebody who knows somebody who knows somebody who knows somebody who knows anyone in the world, 6 degrees. And the way that he did that study was that he and his students or he and his research assistants sent out these packets to people kind of randomly chosen throughout the U.S. and they were directed to send the package on to the person who they thought was the closest to this final address. And what they found was that those packages, found their destination much more quickly than they expected, and it led them to hypothesize that everyone is connected to everyone by no more than 6 degrees of separation. The interesting thing about that study is that, of course, you don't know who everyone in your social circle knows. And so if you're asked to predict who's the most likely to know somebody else, so if somebody asked me, like, okay, like this person in South Korea, who do you think in your circle is most likely to know them? I don't have all the information necessary to make an accurate guess about that. So my favorite thing about the 6 degrees of separation study is that we're probably actually more closely linked than 6 degrees. In any case, we now have new technologies to measure that sort of thing. That's also why we've sort of revised the 6 degrees of separation hypothesis. So now we can actually develop these structural visualizations of how people are connected to other people, or how flows happen between things. And so we use network analysis now to study all sorts of topics. So not just how people are connected to to other people, like who knows who, but also we've used it for like electrical grids. We use it for epidemiology. They've used it in international intelligence operations. And the basis of it is that you're developing lists of people or things that are connected to each other on the basis of either a shared characteristic or a directional flow. So you're creating a graph of all of the things in the system or people in this system who are connected to one another. And then you can run a bunch of statistical analysis on it that measure, you know, who's the most connected or what's the most connected. You can detect the hubs. You can detect mini communities. You can detect like kind of local power versus structural like influence over the network as a whole. And it helps to get a sense of like the big picture of these either social systems or networks of things. So the way that I used network analysis is that I connected site workers and archaeologists. I drew a line between them if they mentioned either the same find, the same archaeological method, or the same theory about an archaeological site. And I liked it because I just liked how visual and how structural, how big picture it really allowed me to get. I was able to be pretty sure based on statistics and based on this visual evidence that what I was finding wasn't it wasn't idiosyncratic, it wasn't ad hoc. It was representative of the picture as a whole. And so when you see the network analysis of the Temple of the Winged Lion site workers and the artifacts that they know about versus the network the positions of the original field team, the archaeological field team in that same network, you can see that the archaeological field team clusters towards the center and the site workers are literally and visually peripheral because they tended to remember fewer artifacts and fewer different artifacts than the archaeological field team. And so you can actually see and measure and detect and provide evidence for the ways in which these labor management practices shaped the project as a whole and shaped the creation of knowledge as a whole. So to me, the network analyses represent like the structure of knowledge from these archaeological sites that's possessed either by former site workers or in the archival data itself. And I don't think that, I don't know, I love ethnography and I love the richness of it. And I'm a big believer in storytelling. My early work is on fiction and narrative, but what I like about archaeology is how mixed methods it is. And so I like network analysis for bringing together that appreciation for quantitative data and storytelling that archaeology is so good at, in my view.
Yeah, and it just shows that there's so much depth that, you know, like you mentioned, the suite of methods that is network analysis has for new applications, like tracking differences in knowledge about a certain topic. So, yeah, really, really, I think an ingenious use of that model there.
Thank you so much.
Are there any favorite memories from your time in the field? Maybe in an interview or particular experiences, sharing meals with some of your interlocutors or learning someone's story?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think what I was finding at the time was very depressing to me. And so my favorite memories kind of come from outside of my interviews. I have favorite memories for the purposes of my research, but they're also sort of clouded by the fact that, archaeology has been depressing. Like I remember the time when my interviewees were telling me in Petra that they knew that the team that I was researching, they knew that Hammond's project was digging at night. And I kind of couldn't believe that that was true. I couldn't believe that archaeologists would be digging at night. I thought this was like a legend. There's often suspicion in communities that live around archaeological sites that there's gold, that there's something good there that the archaeologists aren't telling them about. And sometimes it's true that there's like more there than what they know about, but the accusations of digging at night just seemed sort of like fantastical to me. And so I remember the interview that I did with somebody who had served as kind of the governmental representative for the project for some years. And he very proudly told me that it was his idea to start digging at night. and it's sort of a favorite memory research-wise because it confirmed something that I truly thought was a legend or that couldn't possibly be true. And it was sort of, it made real this sort of fantasy in my head, but it's certainly not a favorite memory in terms of experience. More in terms of my favorite time in the field, you know, there's a saying in Arabic, but I think it applies, it applied to my experience in Turkey as well, that they say that the guest is a prince when he arrives, a prisoner when he stays, and a poet when he leaves. And so it means that they treat you like so well when you come and then you can't leave. Like you're sort of, you're being laden with gifts of tea and fruit and desserts and dinner and all these things. And then you're a poet when you leave because what you say about your experience, you're supposed to kind of, or they expect that you will like, describe it in rich detail. And so I hope that I'm doing that justice. My experience in both sites was so generous and so hospitable. I have memories of like playing with kids, so many cups of tea, like endless cups of tea, homemade mamul, which is like a date dessert, in Çatalhöyük in Turkey. I mentioned one time that apricots were my favorite fruit, and then like every house I went to gave me like armfuls of apricots, like embarrassing to carry this amount of apricots. I was like welcomed into every shop or every cafe in Petra. They would offer me anything from behind the bench. So many dinners. And then my favorite sort of brief story from my time in Petra specifically was that one time I was running a race in Wadi Rum. There was a 10K at midnight being held, and I wanted to run it. And one of the requirements was to have a whistle. And I did not own a whistle. I did not bring a whistle to the field for some reason. I don't know why that slipped my mind, but I did not have a whistle. So I had to go buy a whistle. So I went to one store and they were like, oh, we don't have a whistle. Go to the store across the street. So I went to the store across the street and they're like, no, go to the store diagonal from us. So I went to that store. They said, we don't have it. They sent me to another store. I knew about a toy store in town, so I went to the toy store. They didn't have a whistle. And I was like kind of, dejected, but I'll find a whistle someday, So I'm walking back to my house, which is up a big, big hill. So I'm really kind of like huffing in the heat, really kind of feeling sorry for myself a little bit. And from behind me, I hear beep, beep, and there's a big truck. And they like this guy leans out and he calls out in Arabic, are you the girl who's looking for the whistle? And he jumps out of the car and opens the back of the truck and like has a box of whistles, like so many whistles. He's like, how many do you need? Like 50, 100? And I was like, two? Like, I don't know, like eight, I guess, for my friends. I don't know. And to me, it just represented how like tight-knit the community is and how my experience of being in Jordan and also in Turkey, but really in Jordan, like everything comes together, everything works out in the end, and people like notice you and are looking out for you. And I just always felt really like safe and protected and welcomed, and to the point where I could be looking for a whistle for like 25 minutes and then it just comes upon me just when I think, all hope is lost. The story of my quest had spread through the community. So that sense of community is really strong. And if it's okay, Sam, I just want to just mention that Jordan has been hit really hard economically by COVID. And so there is a GoFundMe that an archaeologist, Leanne Bedell, is running to support the Bedouel community, which is the community that really welcomed me so much when I was in Jordan. And so it's searchable on GoFundMe. So it's to help the Bedouel in Petra. I don't know if there's a way to put it in like show notes or anything, but
send me that link and I'll make sure it's included in the blog post that is associated with this episode.
Okay, awesome. Yeah, it looks like it's fully funded right now, but really people are really going hungry right now, which is sort of hard to imagine for how full and sated they kept me in the years that I was doing this work. So I'd really love to encourage people to support them, because Petra is only yeah, Petra is what it is. That it's a hospitable place because of the people who live there. And so whatever we can do as a community to support them, I think is really important.
Of course. Yeah. Thank you for sharing that. And, you know, you were part of this community for so long and they welcomed you. It's good to, advocate for them when once you're, you know, a different part of it.
Exactly.
So this book concludes with a call to change the way that archaeological projects across the Middle East can better invite their site workers to participate in multivocal knowledge production. So how can archaeological projects actually change their relationship with local site workers so that locals utilize the full extent of their archaeological expertise as not just participants, but partners? And you give one really example of photography in the book.
Yeah. So as I said at the beginning of the podcast, I really didn't want to write a book that was just critique and didn't offer hope or a way forward. Because I don't think this is a hopeless situation. I do think there's capacity for change. And so when I ran these not huge scale projects or experiments, but I ran these, you know, multi-week, multi-month experiments at Petra and at Çatalhöyük, where I gave the site workers cameras to document the site from their perspective. And it was a really incredible experience because I didn't expect it to map so well onto the sort of networks of expertise that I had documented at these two places. So at Çatalhöyük, a lot of the photos looked very similar to what the photos the archaeologists had taken in the past, but not exactly. A lot of the photos from Çatalhöyük were of like equipment by itself, which is something that we like flotation equipment, which is something that the site workers would see and experience that maybe most archaeologists wouldn't. A lot of the photos from Çatalhöyük decentered the archaeologists. So unlike the ones in the Çatalhöyük photographic archive where the subject was at the center, the site workers kind of put them off in the corner, or had them very darkly lit or something. So they looked similar but different to what the archaeologists had documented, which is in a nutshell exactly what I had found about site workers' expertise about the site, that it was similar but different from what the archaeologists had recorded over all these years. At Petra, the photos from the site workers were like totally different from what the archaeologists had taken. There were a bunch of selfies. There were photos of the surroundings of the archaeological site instead of the site itself. Nothing was ever kind of clean and prepared. There were like surveillance photos taken of people or institutions that were maybe not making great conservation decisions that the site workers were very inflamed by. These photographic experiments to me showed that involving site workers in recording could be a potential way forward. I don't want to like overstate the potential of photography specifically, simply because I think there's a lot of ways that we could reimagine a site worker's role on an archaeological site. And that's really what I think the solution boils down to, is actually changing what we hire local workers for. What is the nature of the job? So right now, I think are still contending with this dichotomy between manual and intellectual labor. And I think the more we bring those together in the actual job design, the job description, and the job payment, if we are paying for both of those things at once, I think it'll do a lot to redress this imbalance and this exclusion. I think we also have to think really, really carefully about the standards that we use for both pay and for dismissal. A lot of us have worked at-will jobs where you can be fired for any reason, but I think it's uncommon to be fired for doing your job well. And so I think having standardized or at least like understood and shared ideas about what constitutes grounds for dismissal in advance in a project is really important. I think we should implement pay scales based on expertise that increase when you have more expertise rather than, inadvertently decreasing the salaries of experts. What I'm talking about overall is really just professionalization of the fields and starting to value intellectual contributions, not just socially or theoretically, but actually materially. There are a lot of I think there's a lot of acceptance now within archaeology that community engagement is valuable in general. And there's a lot of talk about the need to listen to local communities. But I don't think it's enough to just say that we're listening. I think we actually have to like literally put our money where our mouth is pay locally hired experts to be experts if that's, you know, if that's indeed what they are, which many of them seem to be. So yeah, so I think it really boils down to that professionalization and material financial valuing of contributions.
Right. I mean, one of the things you mention in the close of the book is that participation in the knowledge production process is one thing, but like you said, we have to listen. And the most immediate remedies for the struggles of site workers are things like better wages and more security in their job and consistent work and maybe benefits as well. Those are things that have been a consistent call from people who work for and participate in archaeological excavations. So, but and you make a good connection between all of these different things and participating in the knowledge production process, getting, you know, more professionalization of the field and how those two things can work together to utilize the really unique experiences of those site workers and actually bring that out. So it's not something that they feel like they have to hide.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Thanks. I think we have some models for what professional archaeology can look like. I don't want to like be overly simplistic or glib about the situation for contractor commercial archaeologists in any location, but I think there are some places like in Scandinavia, the UK, where this is there are like standards for the career path. There are unions. And you have a contract and, you know, it's an official job. And I think very often in places, especially in the global South, there is a tradition of hiring local community members, you know, with just cash I don't want to paint with an overly broad brush about this either, but in what I've seen about archaeological labor, not just in the Middle East, but also in other post-colonial settings, this does seem to be a trend or a longstanding practice of sort of, paying people casually and having extremely short-term contracts that aren't going to be scrutinized, never need to be like physically written down, and often kind of operate outside of what the other standards for work might be in that country or in that context. I can tell you that in Jordan, there's like a length of work at which you're supposed to start paying social security and health insurance to the government. And I know for sure that there are projects that have worked for that length of time and have not paid for those benefits, like you're saying. And so I just think that this is, this professionalization of the field and thinking about all archaeological work as intellectual as well as physical, I think is going to be really important to actually making change in who gets to participate in knowledge production.
Sure. Well, I think I've taken up enough of your time, but just one last question. What comes next? So you're currently at the American Center of Research in Jordan. Can you tease a little bit about what you're working on now?
Yeah, I would love to. So I am here conducting research for my next project, which is called Turning Over the Spade. And it is about literally what came next in Jordan after I finished this book. So as I was, you know, typing up the final pages of this manuscript of Why Those Who Shovel Are Silent, there were two startup companies in Jordan, two nonprofit corporations that started with the goal of redefining archaeological labor and certifying expertise and advocating for workers' rights. So one is called Sela. It's in the south of Jordan. It was formed by five members of the community there. And then the other company is called Hand by Hand, and it's in the north. It's in Umm Al Jamal in Jordan. And so I have been following these companies for 5 years, six because of Corona. I would have probably finished last year, but I wasn't in the cards. And just seen in what ways they've been successful, what stopping points they've encountered. And I'm really excited about this project. I think it speaks a lot to cultural heritage in general, why a lot of community engagement efforts, both in archaeology and cultural heritage, but also in like humanitarianism and in sustainable development, why these initiatives fail. I think a lot of it comes down to some of the kind of transnational legacies that I point to in the first book, but also some issues of identity, gender, and of course, you know, broadly systems of power. So I'm really excited about this one and that book. I'm hoping to finish that manuscript this year, so it should not be too long before Turning Over the Spade comes out as like, honestly, kind of a sequel to this first book. I don't think academics normally get to write sequels, but I'm hoping this will be really my, the Terminator 2 to my Terminator 1, both good, but, you know, upping the ante.
Great. So definitely something to look forward to in the near future.
I hope so.
So thank you again so much, Allison, for taking the time to share your thoughts and talk about your book. Why Those Who Shovel Are Silent is available now from University Press of Colorado. Thank you to all those tuning in, and we'll see you again next time.